You're listening to event audio from the Brookings Events Podcast, part of the Brookings Podcast Network. For more in-depth analysis and commentary from Brookings scholars and our guests, go to brookings.edu/podcasts or listen via Apple Podcasts or your favorite podcast app. Don't forget to follow us on Twitter at Policy Podcasts.
Good afternoon. I'm Daryl West, Director of the Center for Technology Innovation at the Brookings Institution, and I'd like to welcome you to our event on AI in the United States and China. AI is advancing rapidly. It is powering autonomous vehicles. It's being applied in areas from healthcare and finance to the retail sector. Today, we're going to discuss how AI is being deployed both in China and the United States. These are two of the leading places in terms of AI investment and deployment. We will look at new developments, what the opportunities are, as well as what the risks are. We'll take a close look at where each country stands in its AI development and what lies ahead. To help us think about these issues, we have three distinguished experts. Nicole Turner-Lee is a fellow in governance studies here at Brookings, and she writes about digital disparities and new developments in technology innovation. Ryan Haas is the David Rubenstein Fellow in Foreign Policy at the Brookings Institution. He writes on U.S.-China relations, and he has a Brookings paper entitled U.S.-China Relations in the Age of Artificial Intelligence that's available at brookings.edu. Rob Gordon is a group counsel and director of the China legal team at Intel, and he has devoted considerable time to understanding the legal and policy issues in China and how they affect American companies. And he's actually based in Shanghai as well. And we do want to thank Intel for providing financial support for this forum. So I want to start with Nicole. So you have written about AI and emerging technologies in the United States. How is AI being deployed here, and what are some of the more promising applications?
Well, thank you, Daryl. Hello to everyone that's here, or my distinguished colleagues as well. This is a really exciting topic, and we could tell by the number of you that are here that this is something that is of just, you know, growing interest, I think, among not just the technology population, but other people who are looking at how AI is applying to various use cases. And I would suggest that one of the ways that we're looking at AI use in the United States is really around how is it creating greater efficiency when it comes to products and services on both the private and public sector. So we've seen a lot of AI applications and machine learning applications when it comes to, you know, just harnessing the power of the cognitive ability of artificial intelligence systems to just do better. You know, I mean, I was reading, I am a sociologist by trade, not an engineer or scientist, but one of the things that we do know with AI systems is that they can harness the memory and the mind share of a human in much more rapid speed than we've ever imagined. And that is both, and we will get into this conversation, promising as well as scary. I think the second uses of AI in the United States are around different sectors. And so as Daryl indicated, when it comes to retail, we're seeing AI applications when it comes to financial sectors, the transportation sector, healthcare sector, educational sector, et cetera. And I think the deeper we go into, you know, how we relate these efficiencies within those sectors, I think the more innovation we're actually going to see deployed here in the United States. So what does that look like in terms of actual examples and use cases? And I'll just share just a couple of ones that most people are familiar with and some that you're not familiar with, and then we'll go from there. You know, obviously, autonomous vehicles is one place where we're seeing artificial intelligence systems as well as machine learning algorithms really much embedded in that. Many of us who grew up probably around my time never would imagine that there would be something like an autonomous vehicle. I think the closest that I saw one of those was in the Jetsons when I used to run home to watch that cartoon. And now we're seeing, you know, very much similar to Star Trek and the Jetsons and all those animated sci-fi movies, you know, where we will actually have cars that are driverless. And AI systems will definitely power that. Facial recognition. I just returned from South by Southwest, where there was a huge focus on facial recognition technologies and the ability to look at the nodalities of the face and to predict that identification is being used in a variety of ways. On our phones, we now have cell devices or mobile devices that recognize us not by a button, but by our face. We are actually seeing facial recognition when it comes to public safety applications being used by police departments and facial recognition used in commerce outside of just, you know, unlocking our devices. Job sharing and matching is another area which is very promising. When you talk to human resource professionals who have to vet through thousands of applications to be able to identify the perfect candidate, or higher education institutions, AI and machine learning algorithms are essentially helping them to sift through those and make what they think are correct assumptions about candidates, potential candidates, which we will discuss a little later, because they're not always perfect. And I would also say in bail and sentencing, we're seeing huge AI applications. Some would again say promising, again, in the decision making that the AI enables judges to do, you know, somewhat problematic, which we can get into a little later, but it's actually helping to sift through the huge piles of folks that are defendants that are waiting to be sentenced or applied bail. I could go on and on and on, but I always say to people, when you think about artificial intelligence, the train has left the station here in the United States. It may not be as sci-fi and independent or remote than what we think. It's as simple as the positioning that comes up when it looks at Netflix videos. Those are using some level of artificial intelligence capability. It's as simple as the recommendations that show up when you access an e-commerce site. It's all being embedded, I think, in some of the very innocuous functions that we have as citizens, and it will become more in detail when we see those applications, Daryl, apply to healthcare, where we're seeing AI systems make decisions around, you know, surgical procedures, et cetera. So it's very interesting, and I want to just be really clear as I study this. There's this umbrella of artificial intelligence, and then under that are these different areas where we're seeing different types of applications, whether it's machine learning algorithms or other types of technological applications. I have to say that because once I was on a panel, and we kept saying AI, 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 and then we kept saying machine learning algorithms, people were confused. And so I think this umbrella of AI systems is, again, going to apply across sectors as well as various use cases that are going to continue to improve the efficiency of decision-making that we as humans were not yet equipped or somewhat equipped to do, but not at the rapid pace that we're seeing AI systems operate.
Okay, thank you very much. So, Rob, you currently are based in China, so you are on the front lines of the technology sector. So tell us a little bit about your experiences there. What are the opportunities and challenges that you have seen?
Sure. Thanks, Daryl. So I've spent the last 7 years in Asia. The last 3 years have been in Shanghai. And during that time, I work for Intel Corporation. I've helped our teams negotiate some huge strategic collaborations and agreements with partners from everything from autonomous driving to cloud computing. So I've been able to see how the technology has really changed over the 7 years that I've been there. But not only have I seen it from a business perspective, I've also seen it as a consumer. I live in China. And so every day that I walk out of my house, I'm constantly surrounded by artificial intelligence systems. I've got, right outside my front door of my home in Shanghai, I have 3 cameras that I can see from my front porch. And I don't know what they're looking at, but there's 3 of them. My kids remind me that daily. I don't ever carry cash in my wallet. I use WeChat Pay for everything. And for those of you who have been to China, you know it's basically a cashless, or it's turning into a cashless environment. I am a frequent user of Taobao. It is basically Amazon on steroids. You can order something in the morning, and it can be there either afternoon, tomorrow morning. You can have something delivered at your desk. If you are thirsty, you want a Starbucks, you want an iced tea, you simply get on your phone. They know exactly what you ordered last time. They know what time of day you ordered it, and they know your payment method. And so if you want, they will send someone up to deliver it to you the very next day at that same time and with your same order. So it's fascinating. I am just, every day, I am amazed at what technology is happening and transforming the lives of people in China, and also myself as a foreigner in China. I've become so dependent upon this. And I just said the other day, I'm actually relocating back to the United States this summer. And I said, how do I don't know how I carry cash in my wallet when I have to go to the gas station.
And
how
do
I
have to go to Starbucks?
I went to Starbucks.
Who's going
right?
to bring you your
Who's
coffee?
Who's going to bring you my coffee? And where, you know, I see there's shared bicycles here in Washington, D.C., but in Shanghai, it's such an easy app. You just scan a barcode, mm-hmm. you get on, you leave it anywhere you want to leave it, similar to these electronic scooters. Mm-hmm. So it's fascinating. I have seen the AI revolution really take off. And I've seen where the United States is doing some amazing things. I've also seen where China has been able to do some amazing things as well. And I've had the opportunity to partner with some of Intel's close competitors, also some of our partners, academia, universities, and I've also been able to see how the industry has been changing over these past, past 6 months.
Right, exactly.
It's amazing. It changes daily.
Okay. So, Ryan, you wrote a Brookings paper on AI in China, and you talked specifically about the possible ramifications for the U.S.-China relationship. So what do you see as the risk and the opportunities there?
Well, first of all, Daryl, thank you for convening this conversation. I think discussing AI in the context of United States-China relations is absolutely essential, and I'm glad that we're doing this. I hope it's a springboard to follow-on conversations. As I think about the impact of artificial intelligence on the U.S.-China relationship, I think about it both at the global level and also at the U.S.-China level. At the global level, I see the United States and China racing out ahead of the rest of the world. If PwC is correct, by 2030, the United States and China will capture 70% of the profits that are generated from AI technologies. So that's $15.7 trillion, 70% of which will go to the United States and China. That's going to widen the gap between the United States and Chinese national power relative to every other country in the world. So at the global level, the gap is widening. At the U.S.-China level, I see artificial intelligence serving as an accelerant of rivalry and tension rather than a shock absorber. And what I mean by that is that artificial intelligence is going to exacerbate many of the tensions that are already latent in the U.S.-China relationship. Technology really is at the core of U.S.-China competition right now, and it's only going to intensify. But looking at AI as solely an accelerant of rivalry or tension, I think, would be missing the big picture. I think the policy challenge that the United States faces is finding ways to separate or disaggregate the areas of friction being caused by AI from the areas of opportunity for cooperation where both sides would benefit. And in order for us to get at that, I think it's important to break the U.S.-China relationship down into a couple different components. The first is the military component. And in this area, I think that artificial intelligence is going to create intensified rivalry or competition. As artificial intelligence gets woven into weapon systems, it's going to increase risk of rapid escalation between the United States and China, which presents dangers for both countries. And hopefully it will incentivize or motivate both countries to come together to think about rules of the road for how to manage AI in the context of military rivalry. When I think about the impact of artificial intelligence in the trade area, I worry that it could lead to bifurcated global systems that's not interoperable. And I think we're already seeing this competition playing out with 5G technology. You know, the countries that are willing to accept Huawei technologies versus those that aren't. And this that could be just the leading indicator of a broader trend. When we think about the impact of artificial intelligence in the political sphere of the relationship, I think that there also is tremendous risk. If either country weaponizes artificial intelligence as a tool to interfere in the other country's political systems, it will create enormous challenges that will be very hard for the United States and China to manage as part of the relationship. So that's all the challenges. It sounds like a pretty tough story so far. I want to close with the potential opportunity, and this is in the social space. There are areas, and Nicole touched upon this briefly, like access to medicine, improving healthcare, improving access to education, where both the United States and China are navigating the frontier of technology together. And hopefully, we'll both be able to learn from each other and share best practices with each other so that we each find ways to improve the ability of artificial intelligence technologies to improve the lot of American and Chinese citizens. And on top of that, both societies are going to be navigating how to deal with all the impacts, all the disruptions that are caused by artificial intelligence. And again, I hope this is a space where both countries can learn from each other as they go forward.
Okay, thank you. So, Nicole, you've written about the problem of biases in AI systems. So what should we be concerned about here, and how should we deal with possible biases?
So I think it's interesting, and all the things that all of us have spoken about so far, it does not say that there's not any type of bias or discriminatory effect that comes out of these systems. And we have a paper coming out of Brookings shortly on algorithmic bias detection and mitigation, because embedded in these systems, you know, are not just computers programming themselves, but people programming these systems. And when people program systems, they come with a set of assumptions, whether implicit or unconscious bias or explicit biases that actually manifest within the actual computation or procedure. In addition to that, people often use, or technologists may use, data, which is flawed from the onset, right? The data may not have enough data points that can actually give a greater picture of what that looks, of what the application looks like, or, you know, skew out disparate treatment or impact on certain protected classes. Facial recognition is a really good example of that. Here in the U.S., facial recognition systems are widely deployed. You know, police districts are using them in massive numbers for public safety concerns, but they're not always right. Researchers around the country have suggested that, you know, in the case of African Americans here in the U.S., that darker skin tones are not picked up, particularly on black women, or they're misidentified as black men. And so things like that have to change, which I think is interesting going back to the China comparison. I mean, in China, the China application of facial recognition technology has a 8 in 1,000 error rate, which I think is also very interesting as well. And you might ask yourself, well, why is that compared to the U.S.? And it kind of goes back to what Ryan is talking about in terms of they're collecting data at several points and in several places. Rob mentioned that. So their data is so much more vast because their privacy protections are a little less stringent than other countries. So that's one factor for that as well. In addition to that, it could be said from a research and development perspective that the differences that exist within the United States are less easy to cast versus if you're in China, where there's a little bit more homogenous characteristics in terms of facial qualities. I say that to say that we've got some competing interests when it comes to the deployment of that technology, particularly when we look at AI systems across the two countries, because those regulatory permissions or those legislative or national permissions allow for China to be a little faster in the development of certain technologies and deployment of those technologies as well, which is why you can have a cashierless store who recognizes you by face, right? And great accuracy, whereas if I were to go someplace, it may not be as accurate as possible, which is probably one of the reasons I never purchased one of those phones to identify my face. I changed my hair up often, and I was a little concerned that I would be recognized, right? Because the technology is not as great here. But those, again, as Ryan talked about, have implications, particularly if they're weaponized in some way, or even if that bias is used in a way that keeps persistent discrimination and inequality standards. So when we were in China recently, and I'll just close here, it's interesting that the Chinese don't look at that public interest implication when they roll out technology in a conversation that we had. They see it, but their goal is ubiquity and not necessarily looking at how different communities react or respond to different AI systems. Where in the U.S., the conversation has been around more white box thinking, as opposed to having these models that sort of go into some kind of technological process and may learn differently, right? We're concerned in terms of civil society and government, what are the potential outputs on community? Will they be denied a loan? You know, will their face, you know, subject them to over-surveillance? Will there be privacy concerns in the collection of that data? So it's been an interesting tension and an interesting rub that I think exists, Daryl, to your point, even when we look at the concept of bias across the two countries.
Okay, Rob, so some American companies complain that they have to share intellectual property with local Chinese partners, and then they worry about how that is going to affect their businesses. How should companies handle issues like that?
That's a great question. It's one of the topics in these current trade negotiations between the two countries right now, whether it's forced transfer of technology. In order to go over and do business in China to be successful, there is some sort of sharing that has to take place. You can't go in as a wholly owned company and expect to operate business in China with the same benefits as a local Chinese entity. You have to safeguard your technology, but you also have to realize that this is the cost of doing business in China at some level. And you have to be able to decide, well, what are you willing to share? And what are you willing to allow your engineers to develop in-country? We have found that what happens in China, at least with the multinational companies, is a lot of the local hires will come and they'll what we call hop, right? They'll stay in our place for 2 years. They'll gather as much information as they can. They'll get a good name on their resume. Then they'll go from an Intel to, I don't know, maybe a Lenovo. Maybe they'll go into pharmaceutical. And with each of those changes, they are collecting intellectual property. They do sign, non-disclosures. They sign employment agreements. How enforceable those are in China is another question. It's challenging. But I think as a company, when you go in and you're setting up these, operations and these collaborations with local entities, you have to realize going in, eyes wide open, that this is a risk. And that's certainly a challenge that we face at Intel.
Okay, Ryan, our colleague Bruce Jones has written that, quote, the era of U.S.-China cooperation is drawing to a close. Where do you see the two nations cooperating, and where are they competing?
Well, that's a big question, Daryl. I guess the way that I would think about it is that the 40-year period of U.S.-China relations that has taken place over the past 40 years is drawing to a close. We are at an inflection point, a transition to another period of the relationship, a beginning of a new chapter. The way I think about the new chapter is one of competitive interdependence. This idea that the United States and China fundamentally are competitive, but the competition needs to occur within a recognition of the fact that both countries also are interdependent on the other. In other words, there should be guardrails around competition, because if it were to veer out of control, it would do self-harm to both countries. And that's the first thought to respond to your question, that we need to come up with a new concept for where the relationship is and where it's going. The second thought is we need to have a little bit more clarity about what it is that we seek to achieve and what it is that we seek to avoid with China. And I would just offer a few quick ideas that I welcome everyone's reaction to. The first is I think we need to be clear about the need to try to deter China from eroding the credibility of our alliance commitments. We also need to try to be clear about deterring China from seeking to establish a hegemonic sphere of influence in Asia that is exclusive and exclusive of us. At the same time, we need to work to continue to outpace China in terms of technology and innovation. And on top of that, the fourth point, we need to try to encourage China to take on a greater share of burden commensurate with its rising national power for dealing with global challenges that we alone are unable to address. Things like climate change, nuclear nonproliferation, pandemic disease prevention. These are global public goods, not just American issues. And China is a leading global power. We should welcome them to sit alongside us in addressing them.
Okay. So, Nicole, in your opening remark, you mentioned facial recognition software. And there's concern that China is using AI combined with video cameras and facial recognition to build a surveillance state. So should the U.S. strengthen its export controls to countries that use technologies in that manner?
Yeah, I think that's the big question that we're having in the U.S. when it comes to these ethical uses of AI, and particularly in the United States, surveillance is one big area. Surveillance is not new. I want to continue to tell that to people. This is not an issue that just came up because of AI. We've had a history of surveillance in this country for years, beginning with militant movements that actually happened over various political resistance. It just so happens that in this country, we also have a constitutional binder that says what can and cannot happen and what's appropriate. So I think, Daryl, to your point, I think because the networks in China are larger, more denser, there's more data collected on individuals, many more places where you see cameras, like Rob said, looking out of his own apartment, that collection and the surveillance use of that data in China is, appropriate for that context, but troubling for us. Here in the United States. And I think that's something that we as a country have to continue to grapple with. And it goes back to, I think, what we've sort of been saying on this panel, these good and bad use cases of AI. In the United States, do you want heavy surveillance to pick up a criminal who has just recently robbed a bank? Of course. Do you want it to be you? Mistakenly? Of course not, right? And so we have these challenges on whether or not, that is an ethical use of AI in ways that actually benefit the public good, which is what we, focus a lot of any kind of technology deployment here in the United States. That's basically the framework that we regulate and legislate. It's no secret that that's really at the core of why we do the things that we do here in the U.S. So I would say to your question, it's troubling, and I think it's going to be a conversation that we're going to continue to have. Interestingly enough, the technology that China is using and deploying is fantastic. And there's much that we can learn from actually how they're doing this, because obviously in the tests that we have around facial recognition, we're not at 100% accuracy when it comes to deployment of that technology. And that continues to come out over and over again.
And they say that by 2020, they want to have 450 million surveillance systems in place. And it's not just facial recognition, because a lot of the locals were, you know, starting to wear the hoodies, starting to wear the face masks, so they wouldn't be facially recognized. So now they've got technology, and you may have read about this, where they can actually identify you based on your walk, your gait, right? So now what are you going to have to do, hop or skip or do something different so they don't identify you? And I know there's a city, I forget the city in southern China, where for jaywalking, they will publicly shame you. They will put your photos up in the local county offices and say, well, so-and-so jaywalked on this day. And so it's like, you know, wow, okay, well, I'll try not to jaywalk next time to avoid my picture being in the post office.
But Americans are doing the same thing via Facebook.
Yeah, so. Yeah, exactly. It's very similar.
We are shaming, public shaming via social media.
Yes.
So, Rob, that fits with my next question for you. So last year was the 50th anniversary of the 1968 movie 2001, A Space Odyssey, that features a supercomputer HAL that goes rogue and murders someone. And I apologize for revealing the ending there. But how should we think about the ethical aspects of AI? What limits, if any, should we impose in order to protect fundamental human values?
Wow. It was also the 50th anniversary of Intel.
And wait a minute. And I wasn't born then. I just
You know, last week, China opened up their second National People of Congress in Beijing. And Robin Li, the CEO of Baidu, made a statement. And he said, when it comes to AI, the two things that he's really concerned, well, the number one thing he's concerned with is the ethical treatment of this data. What do we do with it? And so much in China, and even here in the United States, is not open. It's not open data. And that's what we want, that open data. The government in China controls so much of it, and they collect it through those 450 million surveillance cameras that they're going to have in place. They control that data. They have access to it. What are they doing? Are they sharing it? You even look at some of the larger corporations, maybe they're state-owned enterprises, and they're getting that data. How, if I'm an end user, who are they sharing that with? I go into a bank to get a loan, and they say, well, no, you can't because you missed a payment when you bought something on Taobao, and now Alibaba shared that data, you know, with Ant Financial. And so do I know that as an end user? And China's also taking a lot of their systems and going to developing countries. They're going to South America. They're heavily invested in Africa, and they're putting these systems in these countries where I'm not sure that people know what they're giving up when they get, you know, see all the cameras on the streets and what are they agreeing to. So these are, I don't have the answers, you know, but these are certainly concerns that at Intel we're very focused on, we're concerned about, I think the tech industry is focused on. And it was interesting, I was with Baidu last week, and we, you know, Baidu's a local Chinese company. Intel, we're a multinational. We're different. We're treated a little bit differently, but we have the common interest, right? We want that openness of data. We recognize that there are these privacy concerns. China has a cybersecurity law that says you can't transfer data outside of the country if it meets certain criteria. Well, as a multinational, we have to process maybe some of our data in different countries. How do we do that? So there are concerns. I think a lot of us that are doing business in China, we're talking, and fortunately, the regulators in China and those that are making the laws, they have open ears. They really are listening. They really understand our concerns. And so I think that's the encouraging part, is that they're willing to listen to us.
Right. And Derek, can I just jump in there too? I think the ethical question is something that, again, a lot of people have become very engaged in, because it kind of goes back to what Ryan was talking about, right? There's the national security weaponization of your information that can be used in ways that shut down your energy systems or your financial systems. But then there's this individual weaponization, right, where you as an individual, because of your loss of privacy or data, you're not sure where you're being surveilled, or you're not sure, you know, why you did did not receive that individual or personalized loan, or you're being denied credit for other things or denied health care. And so I think those are, again, use cases when it comes to cooperation. And I think this is another area where there's been some discussion from a global governance perspective. Where are these use cases that we need to be very careful of deploying AI systems as the only answer without any type of human moderation or any type of global governance structure around those kind of conversations? Because if not, it becomes a free-for-all, and it becomes this race to the top, and it basically subjects people, citizens, to, you know, not only the good but the bad. And that's where I think it becomes really challenging.
So, Ryan, at the previous party Congress, not the one last week, but the one before that, China announced its plan to spend $150 billion on AI over the next decade and become the global leader by 2030. So how big of a problem is this for the United States, and how should the United States think about responding to that?
Well, it's clear that the United States and China have different models for addressing this issue of artificial intelligence. The Chinese model is a state-driven, centralized model where they're trying to drive forward progress as quickly as possible. They've established these benchmarks that they're trying to hit. By 2025, which is 6 years from now, China wants to be making major breakthroughs on artificial intelligence. And by 2030, they want to be a world leader in artificial intelligence. They also want to try to reduce their reliance upon external inputs to fuel their technology innovation. And so they've put together an ambitious agenda. I read recently that the city of Tianjin is going to outspend the European Union in terms of AI research and development over the next several years. That's an extraordinary thought, the fact that a city that most of you probably have heard of, but many Americans probably haven't, is going to outspend the European Union. So there's no question that the Chinese are devoting massive amounts of resources to achieve their ambitions. So the question then is, what should we do? And I think that there's a healthy debate that's already beginning about this. Senator Rubio recently has called for an American form of industrial policy to compete with the Chinese. Others are a little more wary of the idea of trying to out-Chinese the Chinese on these issues, and think that we should have a little more confidence in ourselves and in the fact that companies like Microsoft were founded in garages. Google was founded by a couple of grad students. There is a method to the American system that's worked for a long time and worked quite well. But I would just offer a couple of ideas. The first is we need to remember our strengths. We have comparative advantages in our ability to attract the best talent from around the world to come want to work and live here. We have the ability to allocate capital much more efficiently than the Chinese do. We have the world's premier education systems. We have a disproportionate percentage of the world's superstars in artificial intelligence. We have strengths in this competition that we shouldn't lose sight of. We also need to remember that the Chinese aren't 10 feet tall. They can't see around mountains. They can't predict the future. And there is a risk that the massive amounts of money that are flowing into AI research and development will lead to bubbles. We've seen this before with other Chinese industrial programs. Misallocation of capital is another problem. Having the party interfere in business decisions is a challenge that they have. And the Chinese also have risk of being cut out from global supply chains, ICT supply chains. And so I would just offer that it's not a foregone conclusion that the Chinese are going to prevail on each of their ambitions and that we are going to stumble. I think that the story is far from finished. I think we're closer to the start than the finish of the story, actually. And I think that we can also look at two models, and this is where I'll stop. The Chinese devoted massive amounts of energy to becoming a world leader in rail technology, and they succeeded. They have done incredible things with rail technology. They also invested massive amounts of money to become a world leader in commercial aviation, in aircraft, and they have not succeeded. And so let's just have a little bit of modesty about our ability to anticipate where this is all going to go.
Okay. One question for the panelists, and then we'll turn to questions from the audience. What lies ahead for AI in each country? Like, if we're looking out 5 to 10 years, what do you think the AI environment is going to look like, the United States and China? Nicole?
So I actually think, based on how I started my remarks, that we're actually going to see an AI system in the United States that is going to be somewhat still segmented and disparate, right? It's going to be very sectoral driven, in my opinion. I don't think that we will see in the United States the integration of AI as we've seen it in China. I think China will continue to lead with that, you know, the fact that WeChat and other systems are sort of interconnected, and the Chinese have created what I consider to be more of an ecology of AI versus what we've seen in the United States. And I think that has a lot to do with the ethical considerations of how the U.S. is looking at the deployment of these systems. So I would say that that's going to happen. I think in the U.S., one other thing I would say, just to echo Ryan's point, that the U.S. will continue. We've seen this with the recent Trump legislation that came out or around AI policy, is that the United States will continue to invest. And we'll see a lot more talent development and university strength when it comes to AI systems and just R&D. I think we're going to invest more money in R&D in the United States more than we've ever before in computer science or engineering projects. I think China will continue to do so, but I do agree that what's going forward is the economic vulnerability of the Chinese economy and the government will actually be what will either grow or doom the growth of AI systems.
Okay. Rob, your thoughts.
So I think China is going to continue to push towards indigenous technology in all sectors. That's not going to change. I do think that they are going to start realizing that they do need to loosen some of their current restrictions, whether it's data, privacy, cybersecurity. I think we might see some changes there. They're already looking at changes in the foreign direct investment legislation. I do also think that you're going to see a more of a monopolistic view in China. You're not going to see all these competitors. We're seeing it today. You know, the Didi car shared services is acquiring Uber, and all these smaller competitors, they're going away, whether it's for shared bicycles, food delivery, online payments. There's many companies that have tried, but Alipay and WeChat are still the dominant players, and there's really, at this point, there's no room for additional competition. So I think you're going to see that, I think you're going to continue to see subsidies. I think you're going to see the government continue to put money behind these, and it's going to make it difficult for foreign companies to enter these markets. I don't see that changing, and I do see China continuing with this mentality that this is a race that they have to win. Mm-hmm. They followed every other race in the past,
right.
But this is the one where they believe they're ahead, and they can actually win.
Ryan, your thoughts on the future.
Well, I think that Nicole and Rob have already covered the ground very well, so I will just supplement it with three places to watch in the terms of the U.S. context. And, Daryl, I'd love to hear your thoughts if you're willing to share them on this. But
yeah.
The first is whether or not we can prioritize STEM training as a core component of our educational system, because this is the pipeline for the future of engineers in AI technology. The second is whether or not we'll be able to improve our immigration system to be able to continue to attract the best and brightest minds and make it easier for them to come to the United States and plug into our ecosystem. And then the third area to watch, I think, will be whether or not the United States will be able to rebuild the triangle of innovation between the government, labs, and the private sector. Those ties in that triangle have frayed in recent years, I think, to the detriment of U.S. economic competitiveness. And it'll be important for us to watch whether or not we can rebuild those ties.
Okay, since you asked me to answer, I will take that challenge. So last year I published a book called The Future of Work, Robots, AI, and Automation. And in the book, I argued that people are going to be genuinely shocked how quickly the AI revolution unfolds. Because when I talk with people, for example, about autonomous vehicles, I still hear people thinking that's going to happen 5 and 10 years down the road. It's going to happen much sooner than that. I mean, even in D.C., Ford is now going to bring cars in for pilot testing. I'm looking forward to seeing how those cars perform on the D.C. traffic circles. That could be a challenge for AI systems. But I think the biggest uncertainty going forward in terms of how AI will play out will be the policy environment, because for most of the last 30 years, in regard to virtually every aspect of technology, America has had a libertarian policy, where we basically have delegated innovation to private companies. We let them develop the products, what products they want, when they want to deploy them, with very few restrictions. Now we are seeing a growing tech lash, kind of a backlash against technology. There's starting to be some policy changes that are interventionists, that are not libertarian in nature. The state of California has already enacted a very strong privacy law. The city of Oakland has banned the use of facial recognition software. You can kind of go technology by technology, and at the local level, at the state level, and possibly at the federal level, there could be changes. So what AI will look like 5 years from now or even 10 years from now, I think the big variable is going to be public policy, but it's uncertain, you know, where we're going to end up on that continuum from kind of a libertarian stance versus a more interventionist stance. On that note, why don't we take some questions from the audience right here. There's a question. There's a microphone coming up. And if you can give us your name and your organization.
Hi, Chris McRae, Norman McRae Foundation.
Actually, if you can speak a little more into the microphone.
Yeah.
There, that's better.
I'd like to go back particularly to Ryan's part one, which was the positive markets, maybe health, education. I was wondering what you thought of Jim Kim's recent idea. It was actually on a LinkedIn interview. He said maybe you could put three groups together. So if you have America and China off in this race, you actually have his five countries which are ahead on human capital, which happen to be, if I got it right, Japan, Korea, Singapore, Norway, Hong Kong, if that's... And then the third thing is, who's actually got the big data which really matters for the poorest? So if you take the Bangladeshi case of 45 years of developing things from the bottom up, the biggest single model for bottom billion banking for the poorest women is owned by the partnership of NGOs, which BRAC is in the middle of, but where the coding has come from MIT, it's come from Kenya M-Pesa, it's come from Gates, and it's now partly Jack Ma. So this gives you an example of maybe how things aren't just a race between these two countries, or at least on the positive markets, maybe we should be trying to create them so they're not. So I was just wondering, you know, are there any markets we're going to get right like that?
I think you stumped the panel on that question.
Well, Chris, I'll offer a quick thought, which is that I hope you're right. I'm not suggesting that the United States and China racing out ahead of the rest of the world is a good outcome. I was just making an observation based upon available information. The reason why I think many people make that observation is because the United States and China have attributes when it comes to artificial intelligence that are just not replicable in any other country in the world. It's the abundance of data. It's the Darwinian entrepreneurial systems. It's the regulatory frameworks that exist. But most of all, it's the talent. You know, there are a finite number of companies, AI-driven companies in the world. 50% of them are in the United States, and a third of them are in China. And so you just sort of, you develop this momentum behind the pace of innovation that makes it hard for other countries or companies to catch up to.
Mm-hmm. Okay, right here on the front row, there's a question. And again, if you can give us your name and organization, please.
Thank you. My name is Neil Chabon. I'm with the American Legion. I want to thank you for taking the time out to come out and explain all the things that we need to know about this topic. So my question is that, at least from what I derived from your you know, testimonies about AI, is that it's a prevalent thing, especially in the consumer market, retail, especially those sectors. But there seems to be a large deficit in terms of the defense federal level procurement of AI technologies. The defense budget that was released at 1300 today allocated 4% of its military budget towards computer-based intelligence systems. Now, if that's only 4%, how can I imagine if that is exactly directed to AI, maybe even a percent or less? So that's all computer-based systems in military defense budget that was released a couple hours ago is just going to those kinds of technologies. So why is there that large gap? And even I've spoken to, I think General David Goldfein spoke here a couple weeks ago, and he made that, you know, that plea, like, we need to get ahead of this, especially on the military aspect, because it's the growing thing. Warfares of tomorrow will not be fought in the battlefield, be fought behind keyboards, or of sorts of that. So even with the people at his level, the Chief of Staff of the Air Force, procuring these, like, ideals, why is there still that lack? And just to give another example, the peak of C4 intelligence or computer-based intelligence budgets was in 2011 in the last 10 years at $11 billion. Last year was 8.6. This year it's 10, so 1.4 increase, like nothing crazy. And then tomorrow and next year is projected at 10.2, so even less of an increase. So why do you guys feel there's that big gap on Capitol Hill or in the military aspects of everyone saying we should do it, but it's not getting done?
Well, I'm happy to offer a thought, but then I'm going to cede the floor to my colleagues. The Chinese, I think, will welcome the trend line that you're suggesting because it reinforces one of their assumptions about the United States, which is that the United States has invested so heavily in these traditional weapon systems. It's built such a dense pipeline interest groups around the development of these major weapon systems, aircraft carriers and the like. Right. It's going to be very hard for the United States to deviate away from these legacy weapon systems without doing harm or dislocations to parts of the American economy. And the Chinese have expected that we would operate that way and also assumed that artificial intelligence technology will provide a leapfrog technology for them because they're not as wedded to the construction of these legacy systems is as we have been. So I hope that's wrong, but that's the way that they're going to see it.
Yeah, I would agree with Ryan. I think the leapfrogging in terms of government budgets around, you know, where they go into next generation emerging technologies has always been slow. It's not just in defense, but it's across the board. And so I think to your point, you know, years ago we talked about cyber warfare, you know, with the quotations around it. Now it's real, right? And now we're seeing artificial intelligence weaponization manifesting in ways, like I mentioned earlier, where it's breaking, you know, it could shut down grids, et cetera. I think until that threat becomes even more realistic to legislators who quite don't understand this, you know, I don't think it's the Department of Defense saying, hey, give us less. I think it's legislators not really understanding also the impact of what this technology will do in terms of national security.
And I'll just add a quick footnote to that. I think the Pentagon understands it does have a problem in this area, so it recently launched an AI center to recruit new talent and to deploy new solutions in that area. A few weeks ago, President Trump issued an AI executive order where he basically told all of the agencies, both defense as well as the non-defense agencies, they needed to do a better job because obviously in our private sector, we have tremendous companies, great innovation, lots of deployment. When you look at the public sector part in the United States, government is woefully behind across the board. And if anything, defense is actually doing better than the non-defense departments in terms of AI deployment. So, but the problem with the Trump executive order is even though it moved things in the right direction by basically saying, hey, we need a sense of urgency on this question, he didn't really allocate a particular budget to encourage AI deployment, defense or non-defense, and he also did not address interagency coordination. Yeah. Like, you don't want every department and every agency coming up with its own AI solutions. You want, you know, more general deployment there. So even though what he did was constructive, it clearly doesn't go far enough. Right there. We don't have much time, so let's take another question right here.
Thank you very much. Larry Checco, Senior Advisor to Serve USA. A question that's unanswerable, and then I'll ask one that's answerable. But the question that's unanswerable
is... We love
is,
those unanswerable.
I love the... yeah, exactly. But is AI improving our lives? And if not, why as a species are we allowing this to go forth? I was in China last year about this time, and it was the first time I ever heard about social credit. It scared the bejeepers out of me. And to bring this question full circle, Daryl mentioned policy. it seems to me, you know, unwittingly, we are giving our lives over to governments that we have to implicitly trust will do the right thing with this information. That scares the bejeebers out of me, too. So, I mean, am I being overly fearful?
Well, I think a lot of people share your sentiments. But is AI improving our lives? I said absolutely. I think anyone in here who uses a search engine, who uses Google, you type it in, instantly the results come up. If you didn't have AI, you wouldn't be able to get those results that fast. There are in the cloud, there's so many things that AI can do for us to benefit us on a day-to-day basis. Going to social credits in China, that scares me as well, right? I don't know that that's the direction that I certainly want AI to go in. Will it go there? It's going there. It's going there actually slower in China than we think. I think we'll see what happens. We'll see what happens. We'll see if it's successful. I think at some degree, at some level, it may. It absolutely may. I mean, there's autonomous vehicles today or that will be coming out that they will be able to calculate your speed and the stoplights that you have run, and they will send that data to the cloud. The cloud will then send that to Geico, and Geico will know that, hey, you ought to be charged more on your insurance, and you're a bigger risk than we thought, right? So that's going to happen, right? Those types of things will happen. Whether your social credit is like they're proposing in China is actually going to come here to the United States, I don't see that happening immediately.
Right. Not without lawsuits.
Correct. Correct.
Ryan and or Nicole, is AI improving our lives?
Yeah, I think
you're right.
So.
That is the question.
No, I think so. I think that there are certain, to your point, I think AI generally is improving our lives. Whether or not there are some things that should go towards automated decision making is questionable, right? Not everything has to have an AI system applied to it to be perfect. And I think there's this rush to not only a race to AI, but there's a race to automate everything that has social costs and economic consequences for workers and others, communities, et cetera. You know, an insurance company deciding to use AI to manage claims in a small town in the United States doesn't mean that, you know, they're going to be profitable because they can manage quicker. It means that there's going to be a whole lot of people in that small town where they've been the dependent employer that will be unemployed. And so, again, I think it's really a matter of what's the objective of the AI, what's the problem that we're trying to solve, what's the use case, and then, you know, looping in some type of consumer feedback or user feedback to actually see if it's actually working. I think those kind of systems are actually going to drive a lot of the ethical cases and the conversations around the ethical use and fairness of those systems.
The lack of our participation.
Yeah.
This is happening to us. Mm-hmm. We have no say in
right.
this.
Well, yeah.
I would answer your question in a slightly different way, and I would also put it in a bit more of a historical context. So this morning we had a book event. Tom Wheeler, a visiting scholar in governance studies, has a new book out entitled From Gutenberg to Google. And so he's kind of looking at the 500-plus year history of technology innovation. And what he points out in his book is technology is always disruptive. So when you ask, is it improving our lives, like every technology improves our lives and imposes threats, problems, challenges, and difficulties at exactly the same point in time. What we have done with past technology innovation is we try and maximize the good features, and then we use policy, laws, regulations, self-regulation, and now we call it crowdsourcing, public constraints, as a way to mitigate the downside. And Tom argues that we're going to be moving in that direction with digital technology as well. And so, you know, it's always going to be a mixed bag because most technologies are dual use in nature. Like even something like facial recognition can be used for mass surveillance. It also can be used to find missing children.
That's right.
And so how do you get the good side without getting the bad side? That then becomes the role of public policy to try and regulate the things that we know are going to be bad applications. On the aisle right there, I think we have time just for one more question. Right back there.
Coming back to Kalpesh Patel, I'm just an average Joe citizen, not affiliated. Coming back to the question, China versus U.S., so does China apply different standards for human safety when they're deploying artificial intelligence? And if they do, does that give them competitive advantage against U.S.? And if it does, what can we do to level it?
Okay. Thank you for that question. Panelists?
So just to paraphrase, I want to make sure I understand the question. Can you repeat the question one more time?
It's kind of, does China apply different standards when it comes to human safety when it's thinking about AI and new forms of technology?
And does it give advantage?
Yeah.
I think, I mean, China, I don't know that they have a different system of viewing safety towards their citizens. I think they're very concerned about the welfare and safety of the citizens. I think, however, the citizens are willing to give up a certain degree of privacy for some convenience. That is absolutely true. They're willing to give up more than I think we are here in the United States. And just the example I gave, they're willing to give some of their social, their preferences so their tea and their pizza can be delivered to them at the office. They're okay. I mean, they know that there's this facial recognition. It matches their national identification card. We would have an issue with a lot of this. But I don't think that China has a different standard than we do as far as the general safety and welfare of their people.
Yeah, no, I would actually, on that, I would say no. I mean, the type of research and development that goes into Chinese technology, particularly in this area, is, you know, spectacular and being very specific around any type of consequence to that. I think that's where, I think it was already mentioned, where the U.S. and China will learn from each other when it comes to these technologies and what are the, you know, safety concerns. But I completely agree. We give up less here. So if you define safety in terms of your vulnerability as a citizen there, that could subject you to greater harms if you are, you know, publicly shamed or you go against the norm in China or you don't, you know, find yourself integrated into those systems. It can make you more of an outlier. And that can have consequences that could be defined around safety, which, you know, beg for another panel discussion when it comes to that. But, you know.
If I could just offer one very brief final reaction to your question, I think that one word that hasn't come up in our conversation but probably should is the word Xinjiang.
What's the word?
Xinjiang.
Okay.
Area of Western China where a Uyghur Muslim population is a majority.
Right.
And where facial recognition technology is being used
in
very invasive ways that from an American perspective would seem to violate their individual rights and liberties. And so there are big ethical questions that both the United States and China are grappling with and coming perhaps out in different directions on. And I don't think that they'll be reconciled anytime soon, but it's worth, I think, all of our considering the fact that we are reaching different conclusions on some fundamental questions about the use of artificial intelligence technology. The final thought is that I hope we can continue this conversation in the future talking about the premise of your second question, which was, does the Chinese system advantage it in competition with the United States and the democratic model in terms of advancement of artificial intelligence technology? It's an issue that I think some of us here have been debating. It's an unresolved debate. It's an important debate, and I hope it's one that we can continue.
Okay. On that note, I want to thank our panelists, Nicole, Rob, and Ryan, for sharing your thoughts. Very thoughtful, and thank you for coming out.